My job this morning is when Mike and I started talking, is just talk about some of the signs and symptoms of substance abuse. Who has been affected in some way, either drug abuse or alcohol abuse, just in anywhere in life, work, family, friends? You've seen it on TV. Okay, right? We have a saying, everybody knows somebody. So I give a business card out to someone. It's because you may not need it now, but hey, your friend may, or your, you know, cousin or something like that. So I grew up in Saginaw, so I'm a local boy. Just lived here. I lived in Chattanooga, Tennessee for about 8 years. My undergrad is in pastoral ministries. I really thought I was going to be a youth pastor and work in full-time youth ministry, but that quickly changed when I sat in rooms like this with families, and they're asking me stuff. How do I deal with my kids' depression, and what do we do about this behavior? And like, I don't know. You want to exegete something? I could do this. We could look at the Bible and extrapolate some sort of thing, but from a counseling standpoint, had no clue. And God was like, go get a counseling degree. And I was like, okay, I forfeited my MDiv. I was in seminary, went and got a master's in counseling. And so about the last 10 or 12 years has been either psych hospital or inpatient substance abuse treatment. And for the last 2 years has been solely working with 13 to 18-year-old teenagers, specifically working with substance abuse and mental health. We do that on the inpatient side. If you are afraid to say something today, I've probably heard it and 50 times worse. And it may have come out of this church. If I want to close the doors and say, hey, this is a safe space, and we can turn the microphone off and all that kind of stuff if we have to. But again, this is the therapist side of me saying, hey, this is the nest and this is safe, and all questions are available to ask. So some learning objectives, sign symptoms, some prevention techniques, and where to go when it's out of control. Any other learning objectives you guys want to throw out there? What is something that you saw this on the list and you're like, hey, I need to go to this because I want to learn this thing? Okay.
Team or whatever that our kid probably wants to be on, and in years past, everybody on that team smokes pot.
Yeah.
So
how do you prevent that? How do you educate that?
I need you to be the one person that doesn't.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was that kid. I was 17 years old, and I wasn't the star basketball player. I was kind of like his assistant, and because he was 3 inches taller and darker skinned, and could jump out of the sky, and he had a brick of weed one day that was like this big. It was like a cinder block in his backpack, and brought it to campus, you know, to practice one day. So I know where those kiddos are at. So we'll talk about that. This is what I want you to hear, and this is kind of what we've talked a little bit already. This quote from Ben Franklin: "An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure." And if you don't take anything away from this today, is prevention. Prevent. You know, how do we prevent heart disease? Well, we go to the gym. We eat right? How do we prevent our insurance and our cars from skyrocketing? Well, we drive safer, right? Now they're putting mechanisms in our cars to follow that. And so everything we do is about prevention. We talked about, you know, I walked in a little bit ago and the previous speaker was just talking about having his daily devotion, right? And it may not seem like a lot, but having a daily devotion is prevention when somebody gets cancer, when somebody dies in the family, or somebody shows up with a cocaine addiction and nobody knows what to do. So today is a lot about, I want you guys to see the signs and symptoms so that you can prevent the catastrophic emergency room event that happens every day. Talk a little bit first about myths, misconceptions. We get this a lot. We take about 50 calls a week of parents like in the midst of some level of crisis. My kid is out of control and can't be helped. It doesn't matter which stage. We'll look at kind of the stages here in a minute, but it doesn't matter what stage, there's an intervention for that stage. And so a lot of people think, oh, he's too far gone. We can't intervene right now. We talked a little bit, punishment and shame will fix them. I have heard every story, almost. One kid grew up in a Bible-believing family, and his punishment was they would take everything out of his room when he would act out or use drugs. And his punishment was to stand in the corner of his room with his Bible over his head. Not like the iPhone Bible, but like the big family Bible. And he would have to stand in the corner with the Bible over his head. That's terrible. That's spiritual abuse. That's shame. It won't fix kids, right? But integrating and communicating and having a safe space, like we talked about a little bit, that will help. They will figure it out. This is just kids being kids. Hear this one all the time, you know, the successful-ish dad and, oh, I remember when I used to smoke pot when I was a kid and blah, 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 and look at me now, I'm awesome. No, Dad, you're not awesome. Your kid's just following in your behaviors, and guess what? The pot he's smoking now is about 100 times more potent than what you were smoking, and it's probably laced with LSD, and he's probably having to do sexual favors to get it. Is it okay if we say stuff like that? Because I don't want to sugarcoat it for any of us in here, because that stuff happens every day. We will get it when he or she hits rock bottom. We're not ready yet. We're not ready for intervention. We're not ready for he'll bootstrap himself, and you know he's 17 right now. He'll figure it out, right? He's not ready to get help. You know, we hear that rock. Anybody familiar with that rock bottom phrase? It's huge in my industry, but you know, there's this rock bottom where they'll hit it and they'll figure it out and then they'll get ready. It's kind of a myth. And then I can fix this. I think it was Albert Einstein says a problem can't fix itself. I'm a family therapist by education, and so I see this as a systemic issue. I love sitting in the counseling office with a family, and I'll look at the kiddo and I'll say like the same five words that's written on the kitchen refrigerator of this family's home. You know, it's been preached to him forever, but since some long-haired, goofy-looking guy says it to him, the kid goes, oh my God, that's so profound. I'm going to do that now. So having the idea that I can fix this sometimes is a myth, and sometimes it's out of your control, and you need some type of professional intervention.
Do you wear candles? That's in my daughter, too, and she'd think you're Jesus, and she'd everything you said.
I get that, too. I get that, too. So God has designed us in this just phenomenally, just amazing way. The more you dig into, I hated biology in undergrad. It was like at 8 a.m. I wish I would have paid more attention now. But God has designed us in such an amazing, amazing way. So everything that we do, we want to feel fulfilled. Like the, you know, that song in the 90s, that God-shaped hole in all of us. Anybody remember that song? There's this longing and this perpetual desire for pleasure and gratitude and belonging and selfhood and actualization, all these things. And if we begin to fill those in the world's ways, it's just this endless cycle. And we know that. I mean, we put gas in our car, we drive it, it gets empty. But there's something about God and the Holy Spirit that we put gas in, we put Him in, and man, that's sustainable. Right? That's kind of like a Prius. We can go forever. But God has designed this reward center in our brain. And so this is kind of where the drugs begin to take kind of control, is because the reward centers are designed and built into us. Anybody like what do we got back here? Tacos, green chilies, and bacon, right? So when we put that into our mouth, what happens to us? We're happy, okay? Yes, that's some kindred spirits right there. I see that, right? What else? What happens to our body when we put coffee or we put the food? What happens to us? Okay, yeah. I had an extra cup of coffee a while ago, and I can feel a little bit of shake going on, right? I don't know if it's this small in this setting or if it's the coffee, right? What else? What else does food do to us?
Satisfies.
Okay, so we don't think about that, but that's how God designed us. That's how God, do we have a pointer thingy? That's how God put together our brain and the emotional centers, the memory centers, our judgments, all of that stuff's like designed. And so we have certain chemicals in our brain, the dopamine. Anybody heard of these? Dopamine, right? I ran like 5 miles the other day and I hadn't ran in like forever. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is why I used to run. Like, this feels amazing because it's the feel-good chemical. The serotonin helps us go to bed at night. It's that anti-worry, flexibility, the GABA. And throw out any questions if you have. I'm just going to gloss over these. The endorphins, the brain natural pleasure and pain-killing chemicals, the norepinephrine and, that fight-or-flight response, and when we experience those, that's the brain's automatic built-in system for us to survive. And this glutamate kind of locks in the pleasurable experiences. So when I get drunk for the first time, my body goes, oh my God, that's amazing. Let's remember that. Right, and then 40 minutes later, you're puking. You're like laying on the side of the curb, and like your brain doesn't remember all of that because it's pairing that association of the dopaminergic release, that feel good stuff, locks that in, and we don't ever get to that bad part. And that's why you have that cyclical behavior that begins to solidify in abuse. The brain just it kind of. As a protective mechanism, doesn't remember the smell of vomit on your clothes or coming out your nose or, having to lay in the back seat of somebody's car to get home. Just doesn't. It just remembers the high. And so that's what solidifies in our brain. And I use the illustration a lot of a lawnmower I have a 65-pound Labrador, and she goes out the back door the same way every time to go use the bathroom. So she's in the house, we let her out, she goes out the same way. What do you think happens to my grass? Right? There's a line where she goes every day, and I'm like, Marley, would you not just like take 7 steps off to the left every other time? Because I love mowing this, and I love it being clean, and I love like having all my grass go the same way. But no, Marley runs out the door, takes a hard right, and goes to her spot. And so that's how our neural pathways develop, is the more we go out that path and the more we dig that trench or that pathway, the more pathways that we have solidified. So we talked about our phones a little bit. It's a reaction. It's a habit. When I pick up my phone and I click that little blue F, my brain automatically does something. It lights up. And there's all kinds of cool neuroscience happening here. Anybody familiar with Caroline Leaf's work? Pick up Caroline Leaf if you want to know everything and anything about the brain and addictions and habit forming and... if you've got a thinking thought, I'm dumb, I'm fat, I'm ugly, I'm stupid, I'll never be worth anything. She does a 21-day detox, and she brings in a lot of neuroscience and integrates faith with it just in a fantastic way. Questions so far? All right, go.
Struggles and where you are today, how yeah. that can be good for them, how that when they're confronted with something like that or they're in that, they're like, okay, there is a way out.
Yeah, it's liberating.
Yeah, or even just to warn them, well, don't go down that path because there's a lot of detours and I'd just rather go on
I'm a huge proponent of us telling our stories to our kids.
Yeah.
I think there's my story and God's story that helps formulate that testimony.
Yeah.
More times than not, I sit in a room with a very disoriented teenager who knows nothing of their family of origin, none of their stressors. You know, dad may make $1 million a year or 10,000 a year, but the kid doesn't know how or why. So I think sharing that narrative is so important because that makes me who I am. You know, my oldest is 6. His name is Tyler. I named him Tyler because my brother's name was Tyler. My brother died in a motorcycle accident when he was 18. Right. So even that short narrative, I can tell my son's name. That story of his name, well, how did I deal with death, right? And what was that narrative look like? Did I use drugs? No. Did I do this? Yes. Did it? So I love the narrative component. And as a therapist, I have so many techniques to help that happen. The kid pops out of my head. I'm sitting in a session with them, and no one knew that dad had an affair. He was a pilot. The only two people that knew were the two people sitting in the room with me. And why is the kid acting out? Why is the kid running away? Why does the mom, like, abuse the kid and not let him out of the house without having a GPS staple to his forehead, right? Like, the kid sneezes in geography, and she's up there wiping his nose. Like, she's compulsive. Why? Right? Because she's projecting all of that energy on kid, which really should be focused on dad, because they haven't done any work. He just flies out of town every day. He's just pilot, and mom goes nuts, right? So that comes out in session, and the kid just is, he's just like, I get it. I'm like, okay, now you can depersonalize this and say, this isn't you being bad. This is mom projecting her stress on you. And it's changed the kid's life, because now dad was able to share the narrative. He was able to make repentance and make it right with this kid and say, hey, I've been carrying this weight and it's affected the whole family. Did I get there? I could talk for days on case studies, so and how it affects us. The field of addiction medicine has drawn this line and says addiction is a disease. I don't think it is. And I don't treat it like one as a therapist or in our programming, because it's only been around for about 100 years when modern medicine has come out and has really begun to study it. Yes, there is tons and tons of evidence to follow or to associate with as an addiction or as a disease. A disease is basically simply defined as a departure from health. You know, I get cancer, then I have a departure from health. If I, contract mono or something like that, you know, there's a departure from my natural state of health. And so in many, many ways, addiction or substance use disorder follows that departure from health. But I have a really, really hard time reconciling that from a faith standpoint, from an original sin standpoint. And so I treat it and look at it as really two very closely intertwined things. And so I like it as a dis-ease, or the AA Big Book calls it a spiritual malady. And so I've got this allergy or this malady, abnormality or whatever, that I'm kind of predisposed to it. So if I watch my parents do it every week, I watch my uncle do it every week, I know me as a person. I don't go 0 to 73.2. I just don't. I have two levels, 0 or 100, right? like there's just this gas pedal. If I want to buy or start playing the guitar, I'm going to involve myself in it for 15 hours a week or something like that, and just learn every lick of the song and play it and know it. And I just don't do outpatient counseling as a therapist. I just invested in the whole enchilada. So I like that idea of it, is that God-shaped hole in us that is the dis-ease that we continue to seek after and try to fill. Questions on that? Because that's a big soapbox for me on the difference between a disease and not a disease. I don't know what to call it if we don't call it a disease.
I guess when you're talking about children, it's a learned, you would call it learned behavior.
And especially when we call it, when we try to label a 13 or 14-year-old has the disease of addiction. I mean, that to me just blows my mind. My brother grew up with childhood diabetes type 1. Like, I don't think he chose that. Like, he may have eaten one too many packages of sour gummy patches or whatever, you know, like Sour Patch Kids. But I don't think he chose that. It was totally different. When I try to assimilate those two, like my brother with diabetes and a 13 or 14-year-old with like severe trauma who's drinking a bottle of wine from the liquor cabinet and stealing 15 bottles of Mucinex, you know, so... what was the question? Sorry. Yes. So it is very, very much a learned behavior. And I think there's a tipping point for that kiddo. There's a predisposition. And then there's some sort of psychological break, if you will. It doesn't have to be traumatic, but a kid moves from California to Texas. That's traumatic. You know, a kid moves from Texas to California. That's traumatic. So there's the predisposition, and then there's something that triggers that break.
Do you think there's a physical predisposition, like alcoholism or a tendency toward alcoholism or drug addiction could run in a family? Did you have a physical weakness?
Absolutely.
But in saying that it's not, I mean, I've thought about this. You know, when we say it's a disease, it makes it sound like it's totally out of your control. It's just something that you were born with, like maybe or developed like diabetes or cancer, or you get a virus. When you treat that, it's not your fault.
Right.
Whereas
you're responsible for it, not me. Yeah. If you're the doctor.
Yeah, it's like, okay, I got this disease, I can just go get fixed.
Mm-hmm.
But addiction is totally different. Seems to me to be a totally different animal that we have a role in it.
Yeah.
Even though, I mean, we're all predisposed to certain temptations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of us are susceptible to some are not.
Right.
But we all have something that's a weakness, weak area.
Yep.
And we're born that way.
Yep. Original sin, right?
Yeah.
Original sin has just followed us for a couple thousand years and just... which wherever it is, you know, some people it may be cupcakes, some people it may be Ferraris, like, but it's still a lust thing that we seek after to fill a void.
Well, don't go
for Porsche. Okay. So yes, I think there is a genetic predisposition, and Caroline Leaf's book will talk about that. A lot of the brain research will talk about that. But also we can reposition that as look at kind of the sins of our fathers type of generational type curse. And there's a lot of stuff out there on that, but you can look at it from all different aspects. My dad was a business owner, small business owner, right? And I don't know what his dad did or his dad did, but I bet there's some sort of entrepreneurial gene that gets passed down. Just like types of food. My mom loves spicy Mexican food, right? So I don't get to take my wife out to eat spicy Mexican food. We all go as a family. My mom and I probably share the same dish that's like the level 5 at Thai place or whatever. So I think there's kind of that both and. There's this spiritual thing that follows us. And then there's this biological thing that follows us as well. And those are just intertwined. And I think science can only call it a disease when they see it because of the brain scans, of the typified behaviors that follow us. So, great question. Anybody else? We have 17 minutes. Cravings. So here's what I look for when we start to see sustainable signs of substance. Well, let's go there. We'll anybody watch this? Okay. Sorry, I couldn't find like a high-res picture that would blow up. Here's some of the real low-hanging fruit that I begin to see when a kiddo has some signs and symptoms. Family time kind of goes away, right? That's sort of natural as you get 13, 14, 15. Like right now, all my son does want to do at 6 is hang out with me. And I'm just like cherishing those days. He's like, I'm like, get away from me. Like we just played for 3 hours, right? So the first thing I'm going to recognize or see in a family system is what's happening to his family time. Has his orientation changed? Obviously, his hormones are going crazy. And so he's going to want to spend less time with family and more times with girls, right? Or boys, or whatever it is, and more friends. But you can see that psychological shift in them. Hey, I don't like you. Instead of this is, hey, my dad, and I'm respectful, and I still like him. I may not want to hang out with him, but there's a disposition change. That's one of my first signs. I was on the phone with a mom last night, and her son ended up in Presby, Dallas, because it was synthetic marijuana or K2, LSD, and Molly. And she was like, man, we knew something was wrong. He's been acting to everyone in the family here lately. And a couple of his friends called me and texted me, have you noticed something wrong with Jack? Because he's been acting like a to everyone around us. So I look for that first thing for me is what's going on with the family?
Mm-hmm. Pretty much they're going to treat them like that. But the second, the grandma, grandpa, and everything else, they're going to treat them special. So, I mean,
yeah.
You know, I'm trying to understand what you're saying, but I have to think that's normal.
Absolutely. And that's where you have to see, okay, this is normal teenage angst, and this is a paradigm shift. And we'll stack it on what is he doing at school? His best friend he's no longer hanging with. His girlfriend breaks up with him because he's all of a sudden more interested in smoking pot than he is hanging out with her and going to youth group. I see this a lot of times with boys is there's an adversarial relationship with that primary caregiver of mom or dad, but then everything else. I've seen twins, you know, one of them falls off the wagon and the other one, you know, continues on the straight and narrow, and this just becomes completely adversarial when you couldn't split them apart beforehand. So yeah, absolutely. Look for all of the people in the family, other than the primary care. I'm always going to be the bad guy in my family. I get it. I just know it. But hopefully that bad guy turns into something as a good relationship later. So school, what are they doing in school? Does the report card reflect it? Does, I didn't put church in here, but youth attendance. Those are kind of those, all the things that they love and desire, are they forfeiting sports, right? I couldn't imagine going through high school without playing sports. And if that was taken away from me, that's why I didn't do drugs. My buddy had the giant thing of weed in his locker next to me when the drug dog came through. Like, that's why I didn't do it, because I couldn't imagine getting kicked off the team and not having that outlet for me to do. So a lot of our kids are giving up these events. Well, it's okay. I don't need to be the starting pitcher anymore. Well, it's okay. I don't want to really play wide receiver anyway. Those are kind of some phrases. Okay, where did that drive go? Like, you were laser focused on playing for TCU and being the cornerback, but why did that? What happened? Look for those things. It could be a mental health issue. It could be, but all of that stuff could move into substance use. And then you have these moments where they wreck the car, something big happens. Doesn't seem like it's substance use related, right? Could be a broke a leg. You know, I was at a party and I got really drunk or high and I fell off of something, but I told you, you know, I don't know, some stupid story, right? But if you see stories that don't make sense over and over and over and over and over and over, could be something. I put the one in here. Yeah. If you have to ask the question a lot, what are you doing? What is going on? Why? I don't understand that behavior. That's something that we're, our family drives in this lane, and you just did something that's over in this lane. That doesn't make sense to me. If you're asking yourself that question, hey, what are you doing? I'm going to look mental health or substance abuse related issue. And those kind of go really, really hand in hand. It's the chicken or the egg there. It's, again, that's one of those debates. Am I depressed because I'm smoking pot? Am I smoking pot because I'm depressed? Answer is yes, in some fashion. So we'll go back to questions on any kind of those. It was a great clarification on the family stuff. Yes, ma'am? I would look for the same four slides that I gave you, right? So if it's 6 o'clock at night after dinner, and the family usually hangs out and plays games, or watches TV or does something together, and you see your kid take their plate and go upstairs, or say, "Hey, I'm not hungry. I'm going to go upstairs and sit by myself." So isolation, withdrawal from activities. I just don't want to go hang out with those people, or I'm not really comfortable going to group, just low mood, whether you have this kid that's always bouncing and jumping up and down and excited and kind of ADD-ish, and then all of a sudden they go into their cave and you see it. I mean, look for those categorical disposition changes. And this is so tough because we're all Western culture-driven, fast-paced, moving at light speed. It's hard to see our kids until somebody wrecks a car, right? This is where we usually see there's a problem. And we don't see, hey, just a little, like, he's supposed to be home at 8, but it's at 8:10. And then all of a sudden it's 1 a.m., right? We have to measure that slide out and look for those really, really incremental changes. That makes sense? Good. So real quick, the four C's that I'm going to look for, these are kind of diagnosable, if you will. When a kiddo starts using, is he having some sort of craving? When I smoke pot or I get drunk or do something that's going to alter my state, every morning I wake up, what do I want? Yes. Okay, I cannot function without going and turning on the tea kettle and doing my pour over and making sure the grind is right, okay? My brain, when I wake up in the morning, is desiring that chemical because it gives me fuel for the day. My brain says Austin cannot function without this caffeine. And so when a kiddo begins, my dog running out the back door, that craving, those dopaminergic neural pathways begin to fire. They begin to say, give me, give me, give me, give me, give me, give me. And you'll see them. They'll get agitated. If it's really bad, they'll start sweating. They'll get antsy. Hey, I just want to leave dinner right quick. I'm going to go outside and meet John down the street. He's got my homework for me. I'm supposed to be home and meet you guys at the restaurant at somewhere off Campbell or whatever, and then you look at your Find My iPhone, and he's somewhere in White Settlement, right? Could be a craving. Car just automatically steers itself that way because his cravings have turned into compulsions, because now he's not really thinking about, oh, I'm going to be late for dinner, and Dad's going to ask me these 100 questions, and he's going to ask, hey, where's that $50 that I gave you 3 days ago that you were supposed to buy shoes or something for school, and you didn't buy those shoes, but now you smell and your car hasn't been washed and there's trash everywhere, right? So that craving turns into some compulsion, and then we sort of have this loss of control. This is the damaging or slowing down of that prefrontal cortex, which teenagers really don't have fully developed until about the age of 25 anyway, in males. Women, you get a pass. It's about 21 that the part of the brain that actually makes decisions and keeps us from just like going back there and eating all of that food and throwing up everywhere is our prefrontal cortex that says, hey, if I do that, I might get fat. I may throw up. I may make a fool out of myself. That part of the brain just kind of stops once we get in this substance use cycle. So my kids walk into Walmart and they clear out the whole section of triple C's, as they call it, or cough syrup. And they'll go back to the bathroom and just ingest as much cough syrup as they can. That's why you can't get cough syrup. You have to get the little tag, and you have to go to the counter, and they have to give you one bottle at a time and check your ID. Because kids are abusing it. Because there's this loss of control. Because there's a craving, there's a compulsion, a loss of control. And then there's a continued use to spike consequences. And so we've had the intervention. We've said, Johnny, look, it's 8:15. You've got to be home at 8. I don't care. I'm still going to go to White Settlement. I'm still going to take the long way home. I'm still going to go do this. I'm still going to go do that because I don't really care about the consequences at this point. And you may think, okay, this happens over a year, right? This can happen in a week. This can happen in a day. That I get high the first time, I steal the whiskey from the liquor cabinet, and I sit in the backyard with one of my buddies, and we smoke a joint. It's kind of harmless, right? We fill it back up with water. We put it back in the liquor cabinet. Nobody knows. Parents come back in from out of town. It's all good, right? I still get A's on my report card. Still played football. But then that begins to happen twice a month instead of one time a month. Then it happens once a week instead of once a month. Then it happens every day. And then you guys are talking to me because now the kids wrecked a car, he got picked up, scholarship's gone, all that kind of stuff. And so this is a very slippery slope. Questions? Yes.
Mm. No smell, you know, vanishes it in an instant. Can fill it like now with pH. Maybe talk about that. And then also, you know, one of my friends with older high school, she said, this is different. Like when we were growing up, it would be a party. It would be like a Friday night deal, and people are getting into stuff. Now it's like a kid will take a couple hits or something and go on for a couple hours, you know, maybe in the morning, and then do this again. And it's kind of like, throughout the day.
Yep.
And she's like, you don't even necessarily know when you're talking to them that they're high or that you know, and this is just just a big shift.
Yep.
From what we have dealt with, you know, in the past and what,
can I,
you know.
Can you back on that? Because my question is similar.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now vape is an appendage.
Yep, one in each. You get your phone and your vape.
Super, you're in the minority if you're not vaping.
Yep.
Parents don't know that their kids are vaping. There's a good chance they are.
100%. Yeah, and they know how to market. They know how to target you on Facebook. They know, I mean, they do.
Entrepreneurs,
yeah.
That will get these, and they are giving it to our kids.
Yep, absolutely. And, you know, when I was growing up, marijuana was the gateway drug, you know, and I think it's vaping. It's vaping now for our kids is because it's so easily accessible. The nicotine is highly kind of intoxicating because of the levels that you can get in it. And then obviously you can go to the THC and the dabs and the oils and stuff like that. And nobody knows the difference. And so it is becoming an epidemic, and I don't think we know how to wrap our heads around it. My clinical director does a talk every month in schools about the effects of vaping. And it's going across the country because we're trying to... I think it's going to take us 5 years to get our arms around it. And how we're going to get our arms around it is all these studies of lung disease and chemicals, the metals in the oils are going to be saturating teenagers' lungs, and they're going to be having breathing problems. And they're going to go, why? And, oh, it's because you've been vaping every day and you know, huff those things and giant clouds of smoke. So I think it really has to, you said the word systemic, I think it has to come from a systemic level, and it's prevention. You know, that ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And so we've, I think as churches and schools and organizations, we have to just beat the drum of saying, guys, this is going to kill you, right? I mean, it was safe sex back in the 70s when AIDS and stuff was, I think it has just shifted across the decades of different things that are killing our kids and we're exposing us to. So we just have to beat the drum. We have to educate. We have to hold boundaries. I mean, you guys could go as far as, you know, measuring. They have like little credit cards out now that you can give your kid that they can't utilize it at certain locations. So you can block the head shops and the smoke shops. And I mean, if you only want them to get gas down here, the street, that's the only gas station that you can put on that card. So you can go as far as that, as locking it down as specific as that on Tuesdays, that you can get gas every Tuesday and the max is $25. And so having a systemic accountability for that, and that goes for all of it. That goes for substance abuse, alcohol, sex, pornography, kind of all these signs and symptoms and techniques for success are going to be the same thing across the board for that. No, it just depends on the level and which vial they use. Because if they're smoking strawberry kiwi, the whole room's going to smell like it. Their clothes are going to smell like it. Their car's going to smell like it. But you can get just the chemical with no additives or flavors or anything like that. And so, like the Juuls, you know, they're about the size of my pinky, and they fit in that little small pocket like right here. Or I've seen kids take them and hem them into the inside of their waistbands or their anywhere you can hem them in, you know, they try to sneak them in.
But there could be residual smell.
There could be. And again, you're going to have personality changes. You're going to look for that, like, okay, here was my kid and my he's 3 degrees off, but that's not my kid. What is it? Is it depression and anxiety? Did he get bullied? Did he wreck his car and not tell anybody? Or is he using drugs? And so we just kind of have to look at that small measurable change, and over time that small measurable change is going to be miles off.
So this was from another session. I didn't get to ask it, but you're a psychologist. So we were told you got to have a safe place for your child to come to you and rely on you, so you don't want to discipline so harsh.
Yep.
How do you do that balance?
It's just relationship. If, like right now my son is six, and yesterday I said that he was playing with his bat in the backyard, and I said, don't swing the baseball bat because you're going to hit somebody. We were on the back porch, it's freezing cold. And what happened? He hit his sister in the head with a metal baseball bat, right? And so we had a moment at 6 years old, and I got down on my knee, and I said, son, why did I tell you so sternly not to swing the bat? So I went and hit my sister. And so right now, I'm preparing for that talk when he's 16, when he wants to have sex, when he wants to do drugs, when he wants to drive his car at 95 miles an hour. So to me, that prevention piece, we can't wait until he wrecks a car to have a moment of change. That moment of change begins right there if you've not done any work. And so that relationship has to be built.
Okay.